KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on this fall quarter of KZSU's schedule. You may have noticed a new theme song for Hearsay Culture. Back when I was doing the show at Stanford, when I was a resident fellow at the center, back in 2006-2007, I played music as interludes with the guests, and I attempted to pick songs that fit the theme of the show. So when Richard Epstein was on, the famed and noted libertarian legal thinker, I played Sting's If You Love Somebody, Set Them Free. Alas, because I record this show in what I euphemistically call my office here in Greensboro, North Carolina, the East Coast studios of KZSU, copyright law prohibits me from using copyrighted works on a podcast. The result is I have foregone music, but it occurred to me in preparing for our interview today with author Jennifer Nails that we could go towards some interesting mashup work that's actually on YouTube that would be a good theme song. So what you heard there at the beginning of the show is the putative new theme for Hearsay Culture. It is Kuteman's Through You, which you can find on YouTube, which is, in my estimation, a brilliant mashup of several YouTube videos mixed together to create a new work of authorship, or to put it more specifically, a song. So I thank Kuteman for his work, and I hope that you enjoyed our new theme for Hearsay Culture. With that in mind, thank you for listening to the show today. As I mentioned, today I'm excited to have on author Jennifer Nails. She's written a book aimed at tweens, which I will ask her to define, a book entitled Next to Mexico, which Houghton Mifflin published a couple of years ago. Jen is both a children's author as well as a writer more broadly and a performer, having been someone who has performed a show that I saw a few times, a one-person show called Lilis. The Lilis character forms the basis for her book, Next to Mexico. And we're going to be chatting with Jen today about her efforts as an author to write for audiences like tweens who are so intertwined with and use technology. As an author, how does Jen take the concerns that tweens have regarding technology and how they use it and how they think about it, and how does she write about it? More broadly, we'll also discuss her use of technology in writing and promotion of works, and have a broad discussion with someone who thinks about technology in a very specific way, writing for the very people whom are growing up in an environment inculcated with technology. On Hearsay Culture, we've had a number of guests on in the past who have discussed children and technology, among them Gary Small, who wrote the fascinating book iBrain, dealing with how children think about these things. Earlier on in the show, we chatted, and this is several years ago now, we chatted with Richard Lanham, who wrote the terrific book, The Economics of Attention, and others, including Annalee Newitz and some other commentators on technology, who have all talked about children and their ability to handle technology, be it social media or gaming or what have you. But today we're going to talk about writing for that audience and thinking about technology in that context. So I'm excited to have Jen on, who is joining us live in studio. We are recording the show on Saturday, September 3rd, but Jen is here in Greensboro and is joining me not via Skype, but actually live. By way of a brief background, Jen has performed and taught improv and solo performance all over the United States and at other international festivals. Her book, Next to Mexico, I recall reading a very favorable commentary on it, and as well as her previous works, including Lilis and Time Out New York. She received her MFA in creative writing from the New School, and she is, like as I mentioned, an active writer and performer. The People's Improv Theater being a terrific group of performers and comedians in New York City. So I'm very excited to have Jen on today. Thanks, Jen, for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you so much, Dave, and I'm so thrilled to be on your show.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
Jen, let's start off with a question that I always ask virtually all of my authors. How did you become interested in writing for children and in writing more broadly?
Well, you know, I started out my career, I guess you can say, in New York as a creative person, being an actor. And I moved to New York right after I graduated from college at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Moved to New York right after that with the intention of being in plays. And I knew that it was competitive, and a lot of my professors told me, don't give up, and things like that. So that was, you know, a nice send-off to go off with that in mind. And quickly I realized that I was not necessarily the Broadway musical-ish type. but it took a lot of really embarrassing and humiliating auditions and the feelings that I went away with, you know, after those auditions to make me, you know, kind of get my head out of the clouds and realize that I am good at performing, but not necessarily Broadway musicals. So I started doing improv, which I loved, and I felt like I found a place there and I felt comfortable, and I met other like-minded people, and I really enjoyed doing it. Improv led me to writing characters. And a lot of people that do characters will say the same thing. I was really inspired by a solo show that I saw in 1997 by a guy named Danny Hawk. And he did all these different characters, different races. He's a white guy, and you know, he did all different races, and I always find that so impressive when a person of a certain race can pull it off and not be offensive and not be inappropriate and really be moving and affecting and all that. So I saw him and I said, that's what I want to do. So I started writing characters, which turned into my solo show Lilith, which you talked about. And from Lilith, after performing that show for many years, as lots of writers will also say, it takes a while to, quote, perfect something, and then it's you never think is perfect anyway. So after about 7 years or so of performing that show on and off, revising it, editing it, I was a little tired of being on stage. I had just done the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which is a month of performing for 30 days. That's redundant, but you know what I'm talking about, Dave. I'm patting Dave on the knee because it's live. And so I thought, you know, I just had this idea that I wanted to turn Lilith into a book. And Lilith is a 12-year-old. She's 11. She would be really angry if I got her age wrong. She's 11. She's in sixth grade. And the play is about her sixth grade year, her final year, and how she sort of finds who she is and becomes comfortable with who she is, because she's a bit of an outcast, and she's just real smart and outspoken and all of that. So I thought for the first time in the 7 years that I had been writing and revising that, oh my gosh, this might make a book of some kind. So I came to answer your question, I came to writing for this certain age group from wanting to be an actress and then doing improv and then making this character. And then that led me to the book. And, you know, I sort of went through a bit of a struggle when I decided to actually sit down and write the book, because I kind of had this this pressure that I was putting on myself to continue performing and acting, and I felt like, am I giving up or am I moving on? And I, you know, you just, as a creative person, you just come to terms with, well, actually I'm being pulled in this certain direction to write more than perform. So I just followed that direction, and I'm so glad that I did, because if I had kept, like, you know, writing new shows and getting on stage, I might have just gotten burnt out and said, let's forget the whole thing. So now, as a result of just following the gut feeling that I had, I wrote the book, and I'm still performing occasionally, and I'm still teaching improv and storytelling. So my book and my focus of writing for children came from this show that I did.
And let's talk a little bit about that show, because I think it forms the context for our broader discussion about Lilith as a character and how Lilith interacts with technology, as well as how you write about it and think about it. So tell us a bit more about that show and the Lilith character. Mm-hmm. I mean, other than her age, who is she?
Okay. Who is Lilith? Okay. Well, you know, as you're asking me that question, I'll give you an example which will hopefully answer what you just asked. In the process of writing the book, you're welcome. In the process of writing the book, I guess that's why you do interviews, to ask and answer.
That's the idea.
Questions. Yeah, yeah. In the process, I actually, this sounds very writerly and a little bit artsy, but in the process of writing the book, I sort of came to know Lilis a little bit better, per se. I decided that while I'm writing the book, I'm also going to create a blog as Lilis, just sort of like talking about how Lilis is feeling, what articles Lilis has read on BBC.com. I actually signed into BBC.com as Lilis, and I had her post, I think on the BBC website it says, you know, have your say, mm-hmm. and you can click in and type, you know, up to however many characters and comment on an article. Uh-huh. So I would do that occasionally. I mean, no one ever commented on Lilis's comments, which I guess is the hope when you do something like that. But honestly, it just sort of helped me solidify who she was, who she is. So she's a sixth grader. She's always the one who has her hand up first. Kind of similar to Reese Witherspoon in Election, mm-hmm. but not quite as harsh or not like as dark. Yeah,
is she a devious character?
Not at all.
No,
she's not devious. In fact, in the book, she's in love. She just desperately wants friends, which I think is, what everybody wants, really. Acceptance and all of that. So she's this, quote, the smartest girl in the class. She is looking for ways to stand up for things. So one of her big kind of campaigns in the book is that she is looking for a way to bring back the art program, which has been cut. So she does many things to show her support for art. One of the things that she does is she creates a blog. Speaking of blogs.
Right.
She creates a blog in the book, along with her friend Mexico.
And let's be clear about that. So Mexico is a character.
Right.
It's not the country.
She's not that crazy.
Right. Okay, yeah.
She's not that weird. But I actually wouldn't put it past her to do that. So she and Mexico create a blog. They try and get signatures. They create a petition. They want, more students to stand up for art. Doesn't really happen. But Lilis is a character who is always trying to do the right thing and to make a difference.
Now, Jen, let's talk about it, because I think it gets us to a further discussion of the technology aspects of Lilis's character. So you went and attempted to interact with the real world,
mm-hmm.
as Lilis.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that's an interesting idea, because we do use blogging and we use writing aside from blogs, but the form of writing not only as a way to express ourselves but to interact with others, and that's something that's not unique to technology. But blogs and in fact comments on blogs or comments on news stories is a very different type of interaction. It's not one-on-one. It's not necessarily real time. Mm-hmm. It's almost a call and response type scenario. So I'm curious, what did you take from that experience that helped you inform your writing?
Mm. Well, I think that whatever content a writer is working on, it always helps to just know what the heck is going on in the world. I know that sounds kind of broad, but I think that, the Lilis that I made up is very well read, very aware, very inspired by the stuff that she learns about that's going on in the world. So I felt like, I couldn't write that accurately unless I was actually doing that as the person who's writing her. So it really helped in that respect. And I think, I guess one of my goals in creating the blog was that maybe children Lilis's age could absorb the news in a way that was appropriate for them to absorb it. You know, so Lilith...
And where is the blog, by the way?
The blog is suffragetteweeklyreader.blogspot.com. So it's the school newspaper... .blogspot.com.
Okay. Yeah. Suffragette Weekly Newspaper.
Weekly Reader.
Weekly Reader. Yes. .blogspot. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. But there's another blog. There's a lot of blogs to discuss.
We'll focus on that.
We have an hour. Yeah, okay. Yeah, exactly. Good. And then I lost my train of thought, but you're going to help me get it back.
Sure. Yeah. So we were saying, you know, so you went into this environment both commenting on the BBC website. I do want to ask you why you chose that site, but okay. Yeah, so go ahead. Yeah, I mean, I'll take that up now anyway. So why the BBC?
Gosh, you know, I think I was so sick of the American media for whatever reason. Now, I know BBC is maybe like the equivalent of CNN Britain, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
But for some reason, this is the most generic thing I'll ever say, but I trusted someone with a British accent.
Oh, okay.
not that you can hear accents while you're reading, but you can just you can hear them in your own inner ear while you're reading them.
Right.
And I feel like what I like about the BBC, especially the website, is that it's so easily accesses world news. And I know New York Times does that and all the papers do that, but for some reason I wanted to go to a website that I felt like maybe a 12-year-old wouldn't initially think of if their mom and dad are watching CBS Evening News, mm-hmm. as my parents did, mm-hmm. you know, or even Fox News or whatever they're watching. I thought, let me go a little bit out of their zone perhaps, mm-hmm. and just see what I can find. And I'll just to pick up from what I was saying before, so commenting on major news stories as a 12-year-old, I thought, might link me to other 12-year-olds who might be like-minded, who might share like the same kind of curiosity that Lilith shares. Perhaps it would link me to them. Mm-hmm. Did it? I don't know.
Yeah.
But you put it out there. I mean, like, just like, you know, Kudamon's mashup, you know, like, I, as we're watching that and as you're playing that as your theme song, I'm just thinking there are so many YouTubes of someone like playing their fiddle, singing opera. And I feel like it's because it extends what they're doing creatively. It extends it onto the screen and it makes it legitimate in some way. And just to see yourself, you know, kind of outside of yourself doing that, it just makes you feel a little bit more like there's some foundation under what you're doing. And maybe that's why, why I made these blogs, because I'm like, writing is such an isolating experience sometimes. And so to reach out like that and say, let me put this stuff that I'm writing online, like you say, it's not one-on-one at all as reading a novel is. But maybe by putting it out there, it becomes legitimate. It becomes something real that I'm really working toward. Because, trying to get a book published was difficult.
And I want to chat about that in a moment. We're chatting with author Jennifer Nails, author of the book Next to Mexico, Two Countries, Two Girls, One Tuba, the subtitle, on KCSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Yeah, Jen, let me ask you this. And this is, as you know, a majority of the guests on the show, certainly not all, are academics. And so I have to be careful that I don't veer into a purely academic sounding question.
I'll need a thesaurus.
Yeah, well, I don't. It's not as much a matter that I'm going to use big words, which undoubtedly you'd understand regardless. It's more that
undoubtedly mean?
Let me grab the dictionary because I have to check it myself. But let me ask you this. I'll ask the question this way. I'm curious, as a writer who isn't, in fact, 12 or 13 years old, but is an adult, but is attempting to create a blog as if, an 11 or 12-year-old or 13-year-old girl was writing it, What elements, and this is the academic part, what were the elements of that blog? And as you viewed how a child might blog, and we have, you know, we have increasingly examples of this, both witting and unwitting. We have blogs, of course, that teenagers create. I think social media clearly has extended the ability of even younger children to engage in a way that, as Gary Smalls, others have written, their brains literally may not be able to handle. But as you think as a writer to in creating a blog as this character, what were its elements? What did it have to have in order to be that blog?
Mm-hmm. Well, my first thought is that it is easier than pie to make a blog, you know. So that was encouraging because a 12-year-old could and does make blogs. So I guess, well, one thing that I started doing when I got no comments, I started commenting as other characters in the book. So, you know, it was kind of another isolating experience, but a funner one. So I would write, I would post something as Lilis. You know, I read this article about this Turkish family, you know, there's something really horrendous going on in another part of the world. What do you think? I would ask as Lilis. And then no one would comment and no one would comment. And then so I would say, well, Mexico Mendoza says this is really unfair because of this. And Nathan Shelby says this and this and this. And Gorpat Geetha says this and this. So I guess what I'm saying is that if I was able to not only post a short and sweet, fired up response to a newspaper article as Lilis would, or rather a website article as Lilis, but if I'm also able to respond to her in little, you know, couple sentence blasts as her classmates, then to me, that feels like it adds more legitimacy to what I'm doing. And I know you asked me, you know, sort of what elements on my blog match elements of a real 12-year-old's blog. Right. Well, I mean, all I can say is that I didn't want to make it terribly long. You know, I didn't want to go on and on and on and on and on and have Lilis, like, getting real personal. But I know a lot of blogs do get real personal. I think that because of who Lilis is, you do get to know her well because of the things that she's saying in response to these articles that she's read. So rather than her having to write a diary blog, you know, you can get to know who she is by what she says about the stuff that she reads. So another thing I'll say that might be relevant is that, you know, I think everybody, whether you're 12 or 47, is sort of in this new mentality in terms of internet usage, because we're always skipping from page to page and we read like a little blurb here and then we click on something there. And so I think in that respect, I wanted to keep the posts short and sweet because 12-year-olds are absorbing maybe as much as, you know, adults are when they read blogs, perhaps.
You know, it's we're chatting with Jen Nails, author of Next to Mexico on KZSU. Jen, we're going to go into a public service announcement in a moment. But as a quick follow-up, you mentioned something I think very interesting, which is that you didn't want Lilis revealing information that we would deem private. And, you know, that's an enormous issue, as you know, as anyone that uses social media knows, and indeed anyone that blogs knows, indeed anyone who uses the internet. You know, you pretty much can type your name into people or any number of databases and start pulling up all kinds of information. We have, and policymakers are enormously concerned about the privacy implications of, again, children using these technologies. You made a conscious decision to not have Lilis post about what she had for breakfast or where she lives or who her friends are beyond mentioning names. You mentioned that. Why?
You know, honestly, I don't know how conscious that decision was, really. Lilis is hungry to know what's going on in the world because she's hungry to tell how she feels about it and to help to change things that aren't fair, as she might say. So her motivation for going online is not to, you know, vent about my day and, you know, my best friend stabbed me in the back and all that stuff, which has its place, of course, and it is very popular to lots of people. But her motivation is, come on, people, even though we're 12, let's still know what's going on and let's still care about it. So truly, I don't know how conscious that was. And if I go back to the early postings that I have, I don't find any, you know, personal or revealing stuff about her. Maybe that was my hopeful foresight into thinking, well, they'll just have to read the book to figure out who she is.
We're chatting with Jen Nails, author of Next to Mexico on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can click on Donate to KZSU at our website at kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to the show and to Hearsay Culture. Jen, the process of writing a book like this obviously requires a consideration of, as you mentioned, how technology might buttress not only sales but knowledge about the book. And I'm curious, as an author, as we take a step back from Lilith, the character, into the writing process, how you viewed technology as aside from Amazon or something like that to buy the book, but how you viewed technology as a way to augment not only sales but, as you mentioned, development of the characters.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a nut that people are trying to crack every second of every day. How do we reach our readership? I will just recall an example of the young adult author John Green, whose unfinished book hit number one on Amazon before it came out, hence the quote title unfinished book, because he posted on, you know, social media that he would sign all copies that were purchased before the publication date. And there you go. So, you know, he has so many followers on all of, you know, all Tumblr and I can't be quoted, maybe Facebook, but it's in a Wall Street Journal article. So, you know, people, namely authors, are realizing this is the way that we have to reach our readers. We can't go to every middle school in America to promote our books. So for me, I I'm still trying to figure it out all the time. I think for me, blogging has been helpful because once the book did come out, I did get more comments on the blogs. And the kids that posted comments said things like, you know, how awesome that you actually made a blog that you mention in the book. And that just felt so validating because they, not just kids, I think when we read something, it's fun to then go and interact with the material that you read outside of the pages of the book. And I think that's the way to maintain interest in not just my book, but in me as an author. And I think that's another tricky thing because, you know, this is my first book. And so it came out a couple of years ago. So when my next book comes out, I want people to have had me somewhere floating around in the back of their mind on and off since they read Next to Mexico. And the way to do that, I think, is to have online interaction. I've also, you know, I have my website listed in my book, as of course everybody does.
And since you mentioned it, what is the address?
It's jennails.com, jennails.com. So you know, children have written to me straight from my website, you know, just to say hello. And I always respond, always respond. And, you know, have had a couple back and forth chats with people. Sometimes a parent will write and say, my daughter read your book, et cetera, et cetera. Which is also so validating because, you know, you put it out, like you said early on, you know, you put it out to the masses, whether it's a book or whether it's a blog entry, and you don't really know what's going to happen. So if it weren't for internet, blog, email, which I know are all really the same thing in a sense, if it weren't for that, you know, it would be really difficult to have any sort of sense of who's reading the book, what are they thinking about it. It's really incredible to think, you know, just recently, none of this really existed.
Well, that's, you know, and that leads us to a somewhat broader discussion I want to get your thoughts on, which is, you know, being an author in 2011, having to not or having to operate in an environment where you need to think beyond the traditional model for publication. And this is true of authors generally, whether you're, although obviously when you're writing something for a broader audience, you want sales. It's not quite the same as doing academic articles, as many people do who are guests on this show, but there's still a larger question of whether our publishing model is antiquated. And so there was an interesting story on BBC, actually, in the last couple of days. I heard an interview with a couple of experts talking about the academic publishing model that exists, where in effect, academics write book chapters for no compensation from the publisher. They write the book chapter. And I've done this myself. You write a book chapter, you give it to the editor, it goes to the publisher. The publisher is going to sell the book, and academic mm-hmm. books, you know, compendiums of essays can go $150, $200. And not only do I not get paid, I have no expectation of getting mm-hmm. paid. Now, that's very different than mm-hmm. the writing that you're doing. And I'm curious to know whether, in fact, in your view, given your experience at publishing Next to Mexico, which was published by Houghton Mifflin, so certainly not a small publisher, what you think of the publishing model, given your experience?
That's a lot to think about. Mm-hmm.
And we have about 20 minutes.
20 minutes, go. Well, I hope I'm not going to be immediately going off on a tangent, but I'll just start.
I'll let you know.
Good. Yep. I'll just start by saying that this book came out in 2008, and I already feel like things are completely different. Okay. You know, just in terms of books for the iPod, the iPad, the anything else we can think of, how, you know, the question looms above everyone in publishing, are these things that we hold and we put in our backpack on the subway and read, are those things going to be of the past any second and we're all going to have Kindles and that kind of thing? You know, in just 3 years, I'm already having to think like, okay, lots of people are just talking about self-publishing your book online. Just do it, you know, put up the money, get one of these websites to do it for you. Is that more lucrative than finding a publisher and having the actual book come out? I don't know the answer to that question, but again, it's another nut to crack. And just in terms of, you know, academic writing and how you'll write a chapter, as you were saying. Are you asking, you know, whether or not I think book publishing is going to come to that in the sense that maybe authors will, you know, sort of take the recognition and experience above the, you know, 10%? In royalties,
yeah, or even the stamp of legitimacy. Uh-huh. You know, the the concern prior to, really prior to the internet, and certainly prior to any notion that one could self-publish, was that you needed that stamp of legitimacy from the publisher, and obviously you needed the publisher to publish the book in order for it to be distributed. We have in academia, and this is true and not just in academia, you have the idea of the reprint, right? If I write a law review article, I still get 50 copies of that law review article. And more, you have authors who, law professors and other professors who say, well, now what am I going to do with these? Right? Some people will put them in envelopes and send them to a select group of professors and say, here's my stuff. But you could do that in many ways just as well via email. And in many instances, you might prefer to do that, not just because it's cheaper, but because people don't want to open an envelope and read something. But that, again, is an academic environment where again, I would love to say that I'm going to be able to retire and have my kids and Heidi live in Hawaii for the rest of their life off my law review articles, but that's highly unlikely. For someone who's publishing at, you know, with Houghton Mifflin, right? Houghton Mifflin, as wonderful as a company as it may be, is there to make money. And you, although you love writing, and I don't mean to suggest that you wouldn't write otherwise.
I hate writing.
We hate writing. Well, there you go. So then you are the perfect reason why we need to compensate authors. But the larger question is, yes, I mean, do you think that the publishing model as it existed, and you raised 3 years ago, but things are quite different. Now in terms of the scope of the range of interactions that people can have. Later on in this quarter, I'm going to have Professor Ethan Lieb, who's written a book called Friend Versus Friend, where he's examining a question of whether friendships need to be regulated, given how friendships are created. Putting that issue aside, the larger question for you is this model working for you?
Yeah. That's a great question, and I belong to an organization called the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, and they have conferences, and they're wonderful, and they encourage writers to, you know, see it through and all that stuff. And what I've heard, not just from them, but from a lot of different sources, writing workshops, teachers, that self-publishing is not the way to go because it doesn't have the stamp of legitimacy that you talked about. It, you know, it's sort of this lower level. And so whether or not I agree with that, you know, I think it just depends on the book. If it's an amazing book and it was self-published, it's still an amazing book, right? You know, but now lately I've been reading that a lot of people are self-publishing, and that because of that, just because of the sheer numbers, and that it's a bit less, you know, difficult to get something self-published, I think it is becoming a little bit more legitimate. In terms of, you know, dollar signs, if I go self-publish my next novel and I make 100% of the profits, you know, then that saves me maybe another year of waiting for, you know, the editor to be finished, another year for the book jacket to be designed, et cetera. Not that those things take that long, but just the point that if I want money in the bank now, self-publishing is probably a more lucrative option. Perhaps for me or for, a certain person, but then maybe, you know, for another person who's got a 6-book contract, obviously not for them. The point is that in a small number of years, I've seen the whole argument against self-publishing start to change.
We're chatting with Jen Nails, author of the book Next to Mexico on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Jen, we have about 10 minutes left, maybe 10 to 12 minutes. I do want to turn back to this technology issue and ask you a question which I think ties in there, which is ultimately the challenge of writing about technology for this audience. As you thought about how you were going to put aside the blog, think about Lilith's interaction with technology, what was the biggest challenge in writing about that interaction?
Well, I knew that Lilith needed to interact with technology. I mean, she's you know, supposed to be this smart kid that knows what's going on. So she can't be, you know, the only kid who doesn't have a cell phone at her school. And just going down that path for just a minute, recently I read on one of these children's book publishing blogs, you know, the top 10 things that you shouldn't do in your children's novel. And, you know, one of them that was pretty high up there was, don't make your main character be that one kid who never got a cell phone, because nobody can identify with that. So I knew that I wanted Lilith to interact with technology, as I said. And I guess the challenges were, you know, where do I put it in so it doesn't feel like the author thought, oop, I better insert computer here, you know, insert cell phone call here. So it was challenging to try and find those opportune moments to put it in there where it felt normal and natural. And yeah, of course she'd reach for the cell phone. Of course she'd go get on the laptop and look up that website. So I did have to kind of balance things out, because I think maybe in an early draft it was a little internet heavy. Now there's one blog that they create in the book, and before there were two, and I just felt like, do I really need the other one? Probably not. So I think balance is always, you know, in some way or another, there's got to be balance in the book.
When we, as we think about these ideas of technology and children, and I've asked this question of a number of guests, and I want to ask you as well, we have a variety of concerns about how children interact with technology. As a children's author, did you want to write about Lilith's use of technology in a way that was positive, or in a way that would inculcate certain values or thoughts about technology in your readers?
Absolutely. Well, like I said, the girls, Lilith in Mexico, create a blog. It's called nogalesflowers.blogspot.com. That's nogalesflowers@blogspot.com. That's their blog. And in the book, they make up that blog because they want to get people to sign a petition to bring art back to their school. So they figure if we can get people talking about it online, they're going to be talking about it at school. The ones who are allowed to bring their cell phones to school, they're going to be, you know, blogging about it on their cell phones at school. So, again, maybe unconsciously, because of who Lilith is, I wanted to put a blog in the book that was like a let's get fired up people kind of a blog, rather than a this girl hates me and that guy kissed me, and you know, and both things I think are realistic among tweens. You know, and I'm not trying to be like the advocate of, you know, the person who's going to like make tweens turn around and stop watching 16 and Pregnant on MTV. But if I have the chance, if I have the platform, I'm going to make a blog that's like a let's do something positive. Let's not perpetuate any of the negative bullying stuff that goes on online.
We're chatting with Jen Nails, author of the book Next to Mexico on KZCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Jen, let's talk a bit about how you use technology, not just in writing, but also in your broader work as a performer. And so in the few minutes that we have left, I do want to touch on this. Because, again, the Lilith character developed in Next to Mexico comes from your one-person show, which I saw and loved. And I am curious to know whether even at the point that you were doing that show, perhaps you should talk a little bit about what that show looked like, whether technology there played a role. Because you have, for example, your Lilith character, as you mentioned in the subtitle, two countries, two girls, one tuba. You take out a tuba, I believe, or was it a French horn?
Thank you. It's a French horn.
It was a French horn. That's right. So you play the French horn on the side, but Lilith plays the French horn in the show. Mm-hmm. I'm curious whether, again, you're thinking about Lilith's interaction with the world around her, which, again, in just, you know, it's a cliche, involves technology, played a role in the one person show that you did as well.
Okay.
Or not.
Yeah, you know, just thinking about the show, it's pretty straightforward in terms of me being on the stage playing Lilith and five of her sixth grade teachers. There is a French horn riff involved.
which you don't have a French horn with you today.
I sure wish I did.
I probably should have asked you at this point. we've never had live music on the show, and this is my opportunity. I missed it. Well, my apologies to the listeners.
Next time. Technology. I mean, like I said, it's pretty bare bones, mm-hmm. I guess. You know, when I was doing the show very frequently, it was me producing it, me renting a theater and doing it in New York City. So I didn't have a lot of budget to put, you know, projections, etc.
Let me rephrase the question a little bit, because let me say it this way. You've mentioned advice that you've read about saying that you cannot have a character mm-hmm. who doesn't have technology as part of her life, right? That is a conscious choice, therefore, to have, as you mentioned, to think very carefully about where technology appears in a book that isn't, and let's be clear, Next from Mexico is not about technology. Technology is one aspect of how Lilith, as you mentioned, communicates with the world, and one aspect of the world that she's in, not by choice, but by virtue of the fact that she was born at this time. But you made a choice in this book to limit the use of technology, and I think in the show, again, my recollection of it is that it didn't play a big role, and my question is that in and of itself a conscious choice for you as an author?
Okay.
So I hope that's a clear question.
Yes, thank you. Okay, when I began writing the show, I think I had just gotten an email address. So this was like around 1999. So in my life, I wasn't blogging, I wasn't tweeting, I wasn't tumbling, if that's a word. So I didn't even think about it in those terms. I thought, here's me, what can I do as a person, as a performer? Let me put it on the stage. If I had been writing Lilith now, perhaps I would consider, you know, adding some sort of technological aspect where Lilith talks on the cell phone to someone, or, you know, Lilith mentions the blog, you know, let everyone sign the blog. I probably would, because that's the world and that's what people can identify with now. But quote unquote, way back then, it wasn't so much in my world. It wasn't so much in your face. So again, I don't think I consciously left out technology when I was writing the show, but it was just more where I was coming from in the world at that moment.
Jen, in the remaining couple minutes we have, this is we've reached the part of the show I should have mentioned earlier, which I call the unfair part of the show, which usually means that I ask questions that can't be answered in the time that we have left, but I ask them anyway. But I think I can ask a relatively narrow question, or at least narrow enough that you could come up with a good answer in the time we have, which is ultimately a question of advice. You know, when you think about what you would say to other authors, and again, you know, the hearsay culture is built around, ultimately, for the most part, authors. Most of the guests I have on the show are either authors of books or articles, or in one way or another are writers. But you're a unique writer, at least for the show, and I've not had children's book authors on the show up until now. What advice do you give as far as writing about and thinking about technology to burgeoning authors?
I would say one of the best pieces of advice that was given to me before I was able to get this book published was to read all the books you can find in the genre that you're writing. And there are many of them out there that focus, or rather that are structured with a heavy hand using technology. There's a book by Lauren Miracle. I'm going to get it wrong. TLFN. That could be completely wrong, but its initials is Lauren Miracle. It's all in instant message, so it reads like a play. So, you know, that could be something inspiring. I would say just get your hands on books published, you know, in 2011, 2010, because undoubtedly, those books are going to includes some sort of technological aspect. And I mean, that's a great question, because you, as a writer, you have to figure out, how do I make these readers identify? How do I make them be burning to read my book? How do I make them come away from the computer screen or step, you know, get their fingers off the text and get involved in my book? And maybe the answer is, well, get some blog in your book, get some text in your book. So reading all the books that you can, and I'm taking my own advice as well, all the books that you can that involve technology that are written for children. And there are tons of them out there.
Jen Nails, author of the book Next to Mexico, and member of the People's Improv Theater. Thanks for joining us on Hearsay Culture. I do want to ask you about next projects. What are you working on at the moment?
Well, yes, Dave. I am currently working on another middle grade novel. The premise is that there are two sisters, one's 10 and one's 12. They live with their aunt. She has just won this crazy around the world in a year trip through the Amazing Race. That's probably copyrighted, but no one's reading it anyway yet. And she takes the opportunity and leaves the two girls behind, and they sort of have to fend for themselves.
And is there, I told you I was going to ask unfair questions. Yeah. This one I know is unfair, and I'm asking anyway.
Good.
What's your estimated publication or completion date?
Well, I'm not sure about publication yet, because it's just been a couple of months. Completion date, maybe a year. Uh-huh. I have another novel that my literary agent is shopping around right now. So what you do as a writer is you, quote, don't think about that one, and write the new one about the crazy aunt around the world.
There you go. And we can learn more about your work at jennails.com.
That's true.
Jen, thank you for joining us today on the show. I look forward to hearing about that book. I certainly invite you back to continue the conversation. But thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to mention a number of guests that are coming up on the show. I'm recording this show in early September because Jen is here in Greensboro, and the Hearsay Culture budget of zero precludes me from paying for people to fly here unless I then make sure that Noah and Benjamin don't have dinner on a given night. But there are a number of guests coming up, some of which by the time the show airs may have already been on the air, but I'll mention them anyway. Among the guests coming up in the fall, and it's a terrific list in addition to Jen, Dean Saul Levmar, Professor Martha Nussbaum of the University of Chicago Law School, co-editors of the book The Offensive Internet, Speech, Privacy, and Reputation, a collection of essays. As I mentioned earlier, Professor Ethan Lieb of UC Hastings College of Law, author of Friend versus Friend, Professor Leah Shaver of Hofstra Law, Professor George Contreras of American University Washington College of Law, Professor David Perlmutter of the University of Iowa, author of the books Blog Wars and Tenure and Promotion Confidential, and I will say up front, as someone who's going up for tenure this year, partially wanted to chat with David about the Blog Wars book, which I've been a fan of, but also because there are a number of professors, both junior and not junior, who listen to the show. I wanted to chat with David about his book and probe it a bit more. So I'm looking forward to chatting with David Perlmutter. Jeremy Zimmerman of La Quadrature du Net, the French internet advocacy organization. Professor Lewis Hyde of Kenyon College, author of the book Common as Air. Professor Helen Nissenbaum of New York University, discussing her book Privacy in Context. And Andrew Renz, a research associate at the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at Duke Law School. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show live. As I'm recording this show, we're in the interim period, so I'm going to skip when the show actually airs, because I don't know that at this point. Generally and historically, it has almost always aired Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific Time on KZSU. But you can also get the show via podcast, and there are several ways you can get the show via podcast. The first way is to pick up the show by going to cyberlaw.stanford.edu. That's the Center for Internet Society's webpage, where you can pick up not only the Hearsay Culture show, but any other events occurring at Stanford. You can also get the show by going to hearsayculture.com and subscribing to the RSS feed, where you can get all previous 150-odd shows, as well as the upcoming schedule. And you can also pick up the show by going to iTunes and subscribing to Stanford Center for Internet Society's page, where you'll get, again, not only Hearsay Culture, but all the events coming up. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming. And to close the show, I am going to close with a further, or the rest of, the Kutamon mashup on YouTube through you. And again, thank Kutamon for his again, because he's posted it on YouTube, his willingness, apparently, to share it with the world. Please stay tuned to KZSU and have a great day.